This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:04 p.m., Monday, March 17, 2025, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Rauscher, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Burke. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Dennis Fukushima from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today in House Resources, we're hearing from the governor's appointees to the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, followed by the Big Game Commercial Services Board and the State Assessment Review Board. We're just hearing from appointees today. Public testimony on these appointees will be held at a later date. Finally, on today's agenda, we'll bring House Bill 33 back up and reopen public testimony. So first up, we will consider the governor's appointee to the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission. The commission is a three-member board, one of which must be a petroleum engineer with 10 years' experience, another who must be a geologist with 10 years' experience in petroleum geology, and a public member. We have in the room Jesse Chmielowski of Anchorage, who has been reappointed to the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission for a second six-year term and the statutorily designated petroleum engineer seat on the commission, with the term ending in 2031. Ms. Chmielowski's resume has been distributed to the committee and is available online for the public. Ms. Chmielowski, welcome to House Resources. Please come to the table, state your name and affiliation for the record, and begin your statement, and let the record reflect we are joined by Representative Colomb at 1:05 p.m.
Thank you. Can you hear me? So good afternoon, Co-Chair Burke, Co-Chair Dibert, and members of the House Resources Committee. Thank you for making time for my confirmation hearing today. My name is Jesse Chmielowski. I have served as the Petroleum Engineering Commissioner at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission for 6 years. The AOGCC serves a vital role in safeguarding the public interest in the exploration and development of Alaska's oil, gas, and geothermal resources, and it would be an honor to continue serving the people of Alaska in this capacity. During my first term at the AOGCC, I led senior staff in securing federal grants and established Alaska's first orphan well plugging and abandonment program. To date, the AOGCC has been awarded $50 million in grants, with an additional $43 million potentially available. Part of this funding will allow for the plugging of 9 wells in the South Central region this year. My ongoing goal is to ensure that all of Alaska's orphan wells are plugged, abandoned, and remediated using federal funding. In addition, I have prioritized advancing carbon capture, use, and storage initiatives. Following the Alaska Legislature's passage of enabling legislation, the AOGCC has taken steps to pursue primacy of Class 6 wells from the EPA. Alongside Commissioner Greg Wilson, I have been actively involved in staffing, drafting regulations, conducting public outreach, and collaborating with the Department of Natural Resources to achieve this goal. I have advanced responsible new field resource development through the public hearing process and subsequent drafting and publishing of pool rules and injection orders. Key achievements include issuing orders for Santos's Pica Field, and ConocoPhillips's Coyote and Minky fields. I supervised the findings for ConocoPhillips' CD1 gas release and subsequent AOGCC action. Beyond my work with the state, I have represented Alaska on a national level as the governor's delegate to the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. This affiliation has been instrumental in securing federal funding for orphan wells. I serve on the IOGCC Steering Committee, and I am a board member of the Groundwater Protection Council, which aligns with the AOGCC's mission and supports states pursuing Class 6 primacy. Alaska has been my home for over 2 decades, and this is where I plan to stay. Continuity and consistency are crucial to the success of this quasi-judicial and independent agency, and I am eager to continue to use my skills to sustain and enhance the productivity of Alaska's natural resources for future generations. Thank you for considering my request for reappointment.
Thank you, Ms. Chmielowski. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, ma'am. Through the chair, Ms. Chmielowski. Chmielowski?
Yeah.
What are the biggest issues facing the commission in the coming years? How's that for a broad question?
Right. I think one of the biggest issues we have is managing federal funding and also ensuring we meet our core mission of regulating oil and gas. So when I started at the AOGCC 6 years ago, we had one federal grant that was less than $200,000 a year, and that was for managing the Class II program, which is injection of oil and gas waste. Currently today, we have over $52 million in federal grants. And so so staffing would be an issue. We have staff time writing to carbon capture use and storage and time writing to orphan well grants. We also, like I said, have our primary mission of regulating oil and gas. So we, 4 months ago, hired another engineer. We reclassed a position. We're planning to hire another geologist. And so I think that's one of our big challenges, is that we've expanded and our scope of work has increased.
Follow-up, Representative Southern.
Thank you, through the chair. And you say, so $52 million a year in federal grants. Have you any confidence that those will continue in coming years?
Through the chair, I apologize. I missed that part. Sure. It's not per year. Actually, it's total. It's a total. We have a $25 million initial grant from the Department of Interior, another $25 million formula grant from Department of Interior. And so those are multi-year grants. And so we have a period of time in which to spend those. There's potential for more grants available, but with the new administration, we're not 100% sure if those will come through. Those grants were temporarily paused when the executive orders came out from the White House, but they're now active again. And we have confidence we'll be able to continue withdrawing funds.
Is it along the same line? Okay. Representative Sandler, then Representative Fields.
So you said the grants were temporarily paused. I'm sorry, it's the suspension was temporarily paused? And if so, what were the conditions? When will we know what the long-term or permanent? If the grants were stopped and the stop was temporarily suspended, what were the conditions or what were the reasons or what's going to happen for final disposition of the grants?
Through the chair, when the executive orders were issued, Department of Interior paused all grants and reimbursement from grants. And that lasted for about 4 weeks. I think it was 3 weeks ago, we understand the states were again able to withdraw funding from the grants. There's no indication that there are any conditions besides what we've already agreed to in the grant contracts. So we just follow the normal grant contracts. The DOI indicates everything should proceed as normal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks, Ms. Chmielewski, for being here today. Section 9 of your enabling statutes references the filing and approval of a plan of development and operation for a field or pool to prevent waste, ensure greater economic recovery of oil and gas, and protect the correlative rights of persons owning interests in the tracts of land affected. So I think I have a two-part question. Number one, is this the main section of statute that addresses development of resources within AOGCC's purview? And what have you done? What should the commission do to maximize development of oil and gas within the Cook Inlet Basin, where right now there's nearly a monopoly operator. So, you know, market conditions do not really lead to a private company maximizing production. Therefore, what can and should the commission do to maximize Cook Inlet production for energy security within South Central, through the chair?
So through the chair, yeah, the AOGCC issues orders, and one of them is a conservation order or pool rules, which, you know, has to do with the development of the reservoir, ensuring no waste and maximum recovery of the resource, and then injection orders for the same purpose, ensuring that the correct fluids are injected in the correct places for the same purpose. And as far as preventing waste in the subsurface, generally the state's interests and the operator's interests are aligned in that both parties want to get as much of the resource out as possible. When it comes to the Cook Inlet, the AOGCC, and with drilling wells, we're not in the business of promoting development. We don't issue leases or do lease sales or special conditions on leases. We, depending on what's presented to us, we use our technical judgment to ensure that what they're doing is correct, maximizing the resource and preventing waste.
I have a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So what if, through the chair, more gas could be produced out of Cook Inlet within Hillcorp's existing leases, but that production would occur at a lower profit margin than the same marginal investment through Hillcorp would produce on Alaska's North Slope? In other words, they could produce more resources and make a profit, but that profit margin would be lower than another opportunity in Alaska, namely North Slope oil production. Does the commission have a role compelling that production in the interests of development under your statutory authority?
Through the chair, the AOGCC does not have a role in the economics or forcing development of a resource. Where one of our strengths is that we oversee the development of resources without regard to the price of oil so that we can manage them for the long term. And so economics don't come into play in our decisions.
Follow
up. Representative Fields.
The statute says ensure a greater ultimate recovery of oil and gas. So I think as Alaskans, my question to you would be, we have a monopoly owner. They are merely fulfilling existing contracts. We are running out of gas largely, with the exception of one small additional unit coming into production. So is it your view that under the statutes there's nothing AOGCC can do to meet the mandate of ensure a greater ultimate recovery of oil and gas from Cook Inlet?
Through the chair, my understanding is that if an operator determines that an asset is no longer economically viable, that is the operator's decision. Possibly Department of Natural Resources could compel something like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got Representative Rauscher, then Representative Stadler.
Thank you, through the chair. It's a three-year term?
6 years. Oh, through the chair, 6 years.
6 years. Thank you.
Representative Stadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Chmielewski, I just want, given the in light of the questions raised by my colleague across the state, I just want you to clarify for this committee and for the public that AOGCC concerns itself with volume production and protection of the resources and not with the profitability or investment decisions of the operators. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Again, just to be clear, it's not your job to make sure we make the most, anyone makes the most money or to leverage one production or the other based on profitability. It is simply protection of the resources. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you, Mayor.
Just want to recognize that we are joined by Representative Eichheit, and Representative Stutz is also here. Representative Klom.
Thank you, Chair, through the chair. And hello. It was nice to speak with you this morning. I had a lot of my questions answered this morning already, but I did have a short discussion with you about carbon capture this morning, and I thought that would be interesting just to give everybody an update on your role in what's happening with CCUS.
Through the chair, thank you. One of the federal grants the AOGCC has received is $1.9 million from the EPA to pursue what is called primacy of Class VI wells, and Class VI wells are the wells that inject carbon dioxide for storage. So enabling legislation, which was House Bill 50, gave AOGCC the authority to seek primacy of Class VI wells. The AOGCC has put together a draft regulation package. As of February 28th, that draft regulation package is with Department of Law for review and also was sent to the EPA to begin this crosswalk process where they compare federal regulations to the draft state regulations. The AOGCC's role would be similar to what we do for gas storage, would be overseeing the drilling and completion of the wells, ensuring that the reservoir selected is competent and would hold the CO2 in place where it's supposed to be, and then long-term monitoring of that resource.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mears, then Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. To follow up on that, I remember speaking about that and recognizing that the Class VI primacy was kind of one of our critical path items for getting CCUS. How's the timeline on that going? Is it as it planned, going faster, slower? I don't know if you're far enough in the process to be able to speak to the timing of that.
It's a somewhat long process. You know, I understand that when House Bill 50 was first introduced, there was an idea of the timing. I think we're probably slower than what was initially presented in House Bill 50, but we're, I think, on a good schedule. We've gotten our draft regulations out when we hope to, meaning we got them out first quarter of this year. So we should be going out for public notice in a couple of months, and then we can proceed with, you know, enacting regulations. It's probably going to be at least a year, maybe 2 years before the EPA would grant us primacy. Although any interested party in the project can still go through the EPA to get a permit for a Class VI well, and participate in Class VI while this primacy application is pending.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. I hear in your voice, ma'am, a fair amount of confidence that the EPA will approve the application for primacy. Again, I'll ask that question, but also to ask you, is the $1.9 million in the EPA grant sufficient for your work, or are you going to come back to us for more money from the state to complete that work?
Through the chair, I do have confidence that we will be granted primacy. It's an iterative process, so if there's something in our regulations that is lacking, we will be told about it, and then we can make an adjustment, ensuring that we follow our state laws and what the EPA requires. So I have a good degree of confidence, not in the timing of it. So of the federal grants, that EPA grant is still paused from the executive orders, as it's for whatever reasons, the executive branch, that grant is still paused. So we're not withdrawing funds from that grant currently. We are using the legislative money that you've given us for time writing, that sort of thing.
And
follow up, Representative Sadler.
To the point, is it sufficient? Do you have sufficient funds? I guess I did not think to ask the question about the EPA grant being paused. So do you have enough money you can keep doing the work you need to do for that?
Through the chair, yes, we do. We've been working really well with CED, our head department, on our budget and our plans forward, and I think we're in a very good place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Hearing none, again, public testimony will be at a later date. So thank you so much, Ms. Chmielewski, for coming and speaking with us. We will now set this appointment aside. Next, we will hear from the governor's appointees to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. The board consists of 9 members. 8 are appointed by the governor, 2 members who are licensed registered guide outfitters, 2 members who are licensed transporters, 2 members who represent private landholders affected by guided hunting or transportation activities and services who do not hold a license under this board, and 2 public members. 1 member of the Board of Game is chosen by the Board of Game and who does not hold a guide or transport license to serve on the Big Game Commercial Services Board. First up, we have online Aaron Bloomquist of Palmer. Mr. Bloomquist has been reappointed to a second 4-year term on the Big Game Commercial Services Board ending in March 2029. Mr. Bloomquist, please put yourself on record and begin your statement.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Aaron Bloomquist. I live in Palmer or Wasilla, depending on which side of my yard I'm standing on. I've been on the board for 4 years, appointed by the governor. Done one full term, I guess. I've been the chair for the last year because Jason Bunch had kind of a weird term because he filled in for a replacement. But we got into for over 20 years now, since 2006, and the board, a lot of work, but I think we have a great team right now. I'd love to see everybody reappointed, including myself, Martin Bonick, who you talked to next, has been a great transport representative, and Keegan McCarthy is new, but he brings a lot of knowledge that we don't have from Southeast in particular. But with that, I'm just going to let you guys throw some questions at me if you have them. If not, I've been working hard on the board, and I'm willing to stay on for another term and spend a bunch of volunteer time. I've been doing it for 20 years on committees all across the state. So we do with that.
Thank you, Mr. Bloomquist. Are there any questions from the committee? Oh, sorry, Representative Fields.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Bloomquist. Corey Rossi was charged with helping illegally kill bears. This was over a decade ago. I think you had a business relationship with Mr. Rossi, and I just wanted to seek confirmation that you were not involved through that business relationship with the illegal killing of bears by Mr. Rossi.
Yeah, to the chair, I never had a business relationship with Mr. Rossi. He's just a friend of mine. He's a friend to this day. There wasn't any bears killed illegally. It was a paperwork deal where they shuffled some, he signed some forms that his friends should have signed. But yeah, I didn't have anything to do with that. That was outside of my purview. I wasn't there and wasn't charged with anything. Troopers interviewed me, but that was the extent of it.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Are there any other...
I had another question, but I can wait a little.
Okay. Are there any other questions before I get back to Representative Fields? Representative Sadler? Yeah,
thank you. To the Chair, Mr. Blomquist, I hope you can hear us okay over that, either a child or a parrot. I'm not sure what that was there. But a question I'd like to ask is, what issues do you anticipate the Big Game Commercial Services Board facing during the pendency of your next term? What's on the horizon for your board?
Yeah, interesting question. There's always new things popping up with this board. You know, we handle the adjudication of any penalties, civil penalties, license sanctions, that kind of stuff. We've got, you know, cases that I can't talk about right yet, but some very big ones on the horizon. There always seems to be two or three guys in the industry that are, you know, out of 300 or so, 250 or so businesses, you know, there's always two or three that are well known as problems, big problems, and they take a long time to work through the process. You know, often it takes the troopers maybe 4 or 5 years to bring a case criminally, and then a lot of times we don't see it until after a criminal case is done. But I hope that's changing. We've worked with the DAs recently to do some license sanctions prior to criminal stuff, which I think is better serving the public in that we potentially can suspend the license and get those guys out of the field before the troopers get done with their criminal case and the DA gets done with the criminal case, which just takes so much time. We've got a little easier system where we can get these things through. I've got one in my hopper right now that's like 35 documents, multiple hundreds of pages that I need to review. So, you know, that's one thing that I think is an ongoing issue. We've got We have the guide concession program coming up, which hopefully is another thing that will help with soil conservation and just, you know, having more reputable guides. Federal lands already have it, and it's pretty well known that federal lands are the place to be in the guide world and in the hunter, you know, in the hunter world right now. So that's a big thing that you guys will be dealing with. Hopefully we can get that passed pretty quick and work on that some more. And then we have just a big package of regulations projects. Our regulations process is extremely slow. And we have major regulations that have been in the hopper for 2 to 4 years, I guess. Maybe even some of them more than that. Things that have to do with supervision, and in addition to that, we've got some legislative things we need to figure out how to deal with problems where somebody has somebody die or gets injured badly or very sick or has cancer, that kind of stuff. We don't really have flexibility to deal with that, so that's probably something that will end up before you guys in the future. But we're working hard at it. We're all volunteers and. There's only, you know, so many hours in a day when we have families and businesses and that kind of stuff, as all of you definitely realize. So I'll leave it with that. Okay.
Thank you. I've got Representative Rauscher, then Representative Fields.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, what do you think about HB 33?
There's so many numbers floating around in my head. Can you tell me which one that is, please? Sorry.
I'd be happy to read the title. An act relating to the participation in matters before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by the members of the respected boards and providing for an effective date.
I guess, to be totally frank, I haven't read all the text of that bill, so I probably don't want to comment on it at this time. It doesn't affect our board directly, at least by the title, but yeah, if I knew more about it, I'd be glad to provide a comment, but I haven't read the whole thing.
All right, thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Blomquist, one of the things that you list in your resume is about expanded black bear baiting opportunities as a member of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. And I guess, you know, one of my concerns where we have public lands, people getting out of their public lands, is that we not be habituating bears to get food from people. How do you avoid habituating bears to getting food from people with bear baiting near urban areas where we have a lot of people getting out on their public lands for a wide variety of purposes, some hunting, some not hunting?
Sorry, an alarm went off while you were asking that question, but I think I got the gist. There's always been some discussion about baiting and habituation, and the reality is that it's really never materialized as an issue, that, especially with the laws we have in Alaska. You have to be a quarter mile from a road and a mile away from any developed recreational facility or home or structure or that kind of stuff. And that seems to keep them, you know, relatively in their zone. And actually, most states that have bear baiting don't have any of those laws. You can bait right in your backyard, and it really doesn't seem to be a problem. It's a very different situation when you're out of bait versus a bear coming into town, eating out of a trash can. I guess I'm in decades and decades of fishing game looking at problem bears. I don't remember them ever having a bear that was a problem from a bait that ended up in a, you know, in a neighborhood or that sort of stuff. You know, and Anchorage in particular is an interesting example because there's no bear baiting within many miles of greater Anchorage or even the hillside because Chugach Park doesn't allow bear baiting. And they have, you know, the hillside has as many bear problems with bears getting into trash and such as anywhere in the state. Probably more, actually, than anywhere in the state. But, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question, but I'd be glad to follow up if you have more.
It does. I appreciate it. And I wasn't asking so much about baiting bears that then end up on the hillside as, you know, I've run into bear baiting stations that are extremely close to the Permanente Road out in the Kings River Valley. And, you know, just want to make sure we have recreation opportunities available on public lands for all. So I appreciate your answer.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I guess just a quick follow up on that. I would tell you if they're within a quarter mile of any road or publicly maintained trail, I think that the regulation even says, definitely report those to the wildlife troopers and their bear baits are an easy thing for wildlife troopers to enforce. They ticket on bear baits fairly regularly when people aren't doing what they're supposed to do. So,
okay. Thank you again.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Blomquist? Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much, Mr. Blomquist, for your for joining us today. We will now set this appointment aside. Next up, we have Martin Boniak, hopefully I pronounced your last name correctly, of Glen Allen. Mr. Boniak has been reappointed to a second four-year term on the Big Game Commercial Services Board ending in March 2029. Mr. Boniak, please put yourself on record and begin your statement.
This is Martin Boniak. I'm from Glen Allen, Alaska, and finished up 1 year on the Big Game Commercial Services Board. We appointed for a second, and happy to be helping out with what I can do on this board. I operate an air taxi out of Glen Allen, been flying commercially in Alaska for a long time, and we are a big game transporter. So my seat on the board is tied to the two transporter seats. one of which is me as an air taxi, and the other is a transporter who operates a watercraft. And so it gives us some variety and diversity on the board.
Thank you, Mr. Bonick. Apologies on your last name. Are there any questions for Mr. Bonick? Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bonick, just curious, as the air taxi guy, what that's a special seat on the board. What issues do you see the board facing that pertain directly to transportation issues, specifically air taxi issues?
Well, we've had a couple that we've addressed and probably others that will be coming up, but two of the ones that jump out right away are distinctive markings for transport aircraft and for guide aircraft that are used by guide services. There's been a lot of discussion on that with the utility of it for identifying an aircraft. So that is an issue that's in our regulations packet. And then another one, I think, is at least it's been just on the beginning of discussion. As guides have different areas, transporters do not. And there's been discussion on whether or not that should be the case. There are times where you can have transporters from a different part of the state bringing in lots of people to hunt in a certain area, and there's no limits or anything on that. And maybe there shouldn't be, but that is certainly a piece of the discussion at this point. There are areas, especially with the marine transporters, that are, according to what we are hearing, kind of overrun with the number of transporters that are there. And there's also issues of limitation or reduction in commerce that have to be addressed. So that's a couple of them. The issue of whether a transporter should be a natural person, at this point it is allowed to be a commercial entity, an LLC or a corporation, which allows a person that has a issue with our board for some type of disciplinary action, maybe suspension or revocation or something of a license, and then they could potentially go out and start a new business under somebody else's name, have it licensed to that entity. So those are things that we're a long ways from any kind of conclusion on, but there's some pretty serious legal issues involved with that. Another one that's coming up that doesn't directly involve transporters is the issue of hunt planners. And hunt planners are people that have websites. They may be somewhere out of state, and they plan hunts all over the world, including Alaska. And if it's something that does not require a hunt that does not require a guide service, then that hunt planner can put together a hunt, find a transporter, whether it's local or not local, put this person on the plane or on the boat, and send them off hunting. And there's no involvement of our board on that, even though it's a commercial service. We are not authorized to do anything with hunt planners. It is becoming more and more of a common thing. So does that make sense? You follow what I'm saying with the hunt planners, essentially someone else doing everything, working with a transporter, and you end up with people not familiar potentially with the area that's being hunted, setting it all up for somebody else out of state.
Thank you. And to follow up on that?
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
And Mr. Boniak, through the chair, a couple questions. I have several questions, but I guess I'd have time for this one. Is the issue of hunt planners and the board's inability to put its hand on them, is that something you can handle through regulations, or is that something you think would need change in statute?
That's probably a better question for you guys. I think it's a change in statute. I mean, right now, we're only authorized to deal with commercial services involving transporters and guides. And hunt planners are neither guides or outfitters or transporters. So I believe that would take some statute change, I think. I mean, probably more in your bailiwick than mine to decide that, but it is something that has to be looked at from the legal end. I don't believe at this point that we are authorized to deal with it. But especially on some of the caribou hunts up north, I mean, we all know that caribou populations are down all over. In our area, in Elgina, we pretty much are out of the caribou business for quite a while, just because of the lack of caribou. But yet up north, you can have hunt planners putting together hunts, don't need a guide, get a transporter from somewhere else, and then have him put together a whole hunt and have someone dropping a whole lot of out-of-state people into that area.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
Good. Can you get him to stop? Thank you. Sorry, got a chainsaw running here. The noise of the north. Go ahead.
No, I'm good, sir. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much, Mr. Bonick. We will now set this appointment aside. Next up, we have Keegan McCarthy of Douglas. Mr. McCarthy has been appointed for his first two-year term on the Big Game Commercial Services Board, ending in March 2027. Mr. McCarthy, thank you for calling in today. Please put yourself on record and begin your statement.
Yes, thank you. Hello, my name is Keegan McCarthy. I was raised in Juneau, Alaska. Graduated from Juneau Douglas High School in 1994. My dad was a wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game most of my life when I was growing up, so I spent my entire young years out in the woods of primarily southeast Alaska, a little bit up in the north. Took a couple years of college, UAF and UAS, and found myself more intrigued with the guiding and commercial fishing world. So in 1998, I became an assistant guide. 2001, I obtained my registered guide license. Must become a master guide around 2014. Started my own business in 2003, really expanded in 2012. We offer vessel bait hunting in southeast Alaska. Beyond that, I've been a commercial fisherman. My wife is a speech pathologist. She works in the remote school districts of all over Alaska in her time. We now have two children, ages 9 and 12. Beyond our work, I do a lot of different conservation organizations I belong to, including APHA, Safari Club International, sit on the board of directors for the Weatherbee Conservation Organization, International Order of Teddy Roosevelt, and a couple others. So very active in conservation hunting world, accustomed to sitting on different boards, but I'm new to this one. I'm very excited and honored. I've been put forward by the governor, and I hope that I can do my part to help give back to our industry and the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Fields?
Thank you. Through the chair, just definitely appreciate the long experience of Mr. McCarthy, and just wanted to give Mr. McCarthy an opportunity to give us some background. I think you have a couple of violations. One is for failing to seal a black bear. One is for recovering roe without a permit. They were quite a few years apart. Maybe just a little background about those violations and what you did to rectify them and not repeat them. Thank you.
Yes, the first one, the roe recovery was, there was 20 of us charged with the same thing. There was generally a misunderstanding through a processor we all worked for that, I don't commercial fish anymore, and I never got in trouble again for it once we understood that it was more of a paperwork violation of the things we were doing wrong. I followed 2 years probation, and from my understanding, that was wiped clean from my record. I checked on that this year, and they said it was. So I think while that was something I'd had, it's been taken care of. The sealing of the bear was an issue where a bear hide was taken into Juneau on board air, put in the freezer, and when they picked up the other ones to ship to Anchorage where we had them sealed, one got left behind. And as soon as we found out, we rectified it immediately, got the bear sealed properly and sent in. It was just a little delayed.
Okay, if I could just ask a follow-up, what was the violation with the roe? I don't see that a lot, so I'm just not familiar with
We didn't have, I mean, we needed a special, it was actually a DUC violation for not having the proper, it's been so long, it was six, right? I believe it was a DUC violation for not having the proper paperwork on board for processing fish.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee for Mr. McCarthy? No. Representative Sadler?
Yeah, thank you for consistency. Mr. McCarthy, just the same question as before. What do you see as the issues facing the board in the next term?
I think that's interesting. Being obviously brand new, I've managed to be on one meeting, and I've tried to listen in on some last year. I think I'd echo some of the things that Karen Bloomquist said. I'd like to learn more about those different things. I think we have, you know, the issue of the guide concession program, which will be an interesting one to tackle. I see, you know, federal land issues. Part of why I'm glad to represent Southeast Alaska is because guiding pretty much takes place all on federal land, so just making sure there's continuity about some of the processes between federal and then actually the Big Commercial Services Board working together with those to make sure those are all lined up. There's been some confusion in the past. I think there's been a good find some of those. I think we have some interesting things we can do with the testing and better create a testing model that better represents what we do, and since we're such a big state, possibly things like that. But again, just learning. I look forward to learning from the board at first and hopefully being a valued member, and I'm sure more things will come up that I find will need attention.
Are there any other questions from committee? I have a question, and I'm not sure if you heard Representative Rauscher's question earlier to Mr. Bloomquist, but it was about House Bill 33, which is actually up on this committee later on today, and what your, or I guess how you feel about that and how it impacts you on the Big Game Commercial Services Board.
I didn't fully, if you could repeat what that House bill is, I think I'd have the same answer. I'm currently not aware of what it is.
It's the Conflict of Interest Bill. So the title is An Act Relating to Participation in Matters Before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by the Members of the Respective Boards and Providing for an Effective Date.
I guess I don't even understand quite, without diving deeper into that, exactly what it would mean or how it would pertain to us.
Doesn't have to pertain to this opinion.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from committee? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. We'll now set this appointment aside. Next, we will consider the governor's appointee to the State Assessment Review Board. The board consists of 5 members appointed by the governor who must be knowledgeable of assessment procedures for pipeline transportation of gas or unrefined oil. The board conducts oil and gas property assessment appeal hearings on values set by the Department of Revenue. Board members serve at the pleasure of the governor and have no fixed term. We have online Samuel Laffey of Anchorage. Mr. Laffey was appointed on October 25, 2024. Mr. Laffey, please put yourself on record and begin your statement.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Burke and Chair Dybert. And good afternoon to the members of the committee of the Alaska House of Representatives Resources Committee. I'm an attorney in Anchorage with the Office of Public Advocacy. I am the nominee, as the chair mentioned, who is the Alaska Assessment Review Board. The Assessment Review Board is the body charged by the state, by state statute, with conducting oil and gas and pipeline property assessment appeal hearings, and most of the appeals typically are on the value set by the Alaska Department of Revenue and are being contested by various private or sometimes public actors. I'm happy to answer any questions that members of the committees may have for me, and thank you all very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Laffey. We have a question from Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Laffey. Thank you for providing your resume. It looks like most of your experience is in family law with some criminal law. Is it normal for an attorney with that experience to then get appointed to the State Review Board? And how would you compare your duration and breadth of experience with other people who have done that job in the past? Thank you.
Thank you very much to the chair, Ms. Representative Fields. I don't know, and I certainly can't speak to whether how normal it is for someone with my background to be considered for this board. I don't know. I do have tangentially some experience and quite a bit of knowledge, actually, about oil and gas development, oil and gas processes, terminology. I took quite a few classes on that when I was getting my MBA and my law degree, and I have done some work previously in the natural resources field when I was an attorney in American Samoa. As to whether or not, I suppose your question is more directly, whether or not I feel I'm qualified for the position. I certainly do, but ultimately that is not my decision. It's yours and the other esteemed members of the Alaska State Legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Laffey. Just curious, where are most of the oil and gas assessment issues, where do they come from? What geographical area, what part of the business? Help us understand the world in which you'll be operating should you be confirmed to this seat.
Thank you. I've only attended to observe a couple of meetings last year. My understanding is most of the disputes come in from the North Slope area, essentially, and a handful of other places, including near where I believe your district is, in the Cook Inlet, where oil and gas is being developed. The things I've observed mostly tend to be arguments about when production started, or arguments about when production actually started, and the value of the cost of the assessments versus the actual amount of production that occurred at specific points, essentially.
And from a
follow-up, Representative Sadler.
And how does your work in the legal profession or your training prepare you for that kind of work, even if your casework has been primarily, as we heard, in family law?
Thank you. My background as a legal professional is, I feel, gives me a very strong aptitude to understand this because I have training in reading statutory and regulatory rules and procedures and interpreting them. And I also have a great deal of experience in reading extremely large amounts of volume of just documents, discovery might be a general term for it, and taking notes, processing, and understanding. And I also have some practical trial experience of asking people questions and figuring out ahead of time, or sometimes on the fly, what questions need to be asked to what people.
And a brief, somewhat more casual follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler, then Representative Klum.
Through the chair, Mr. Laffey. So how is it you're able to get your JD and your MBA on the same timeline? That sounds like you're a pretty busy guy for a couple of years there.
Well, it was fairly busy. I did a four instead of 5-year program. Normally it takes 5 years to get both degrees, but I did a joint degree program while I was at the University of Wyoming. I did 1 year of law school followed by an entire year of my MBA, and then I did alternating between MBA classes and law classes the remaining 2 years. So that's how I was able to commence with, or graduate with both degrees at the same time.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. This is just I'm trying to figure kind of what the role is with the State Assessment Review Board. So when you have an assessment and someone wants to argue that, is that the board's job to create that settlement between the state and private parties, or does that go to a different department when there's a disagreement?
Thank you for your question, and to the chair, Representative Kumbo. Here's generally how I understand how the process works. I think that the State Department of Revenue, which is separate from the board, they spend a lot of time trying to, negotiate or come to an understanding before a formal appeal is filed. I think a good equivalency might be, say, the Assessment Review Board in the municipality of Anchorage, mm-hmm. where most people don't actually go in front of the Assessment Review Board for municipality of Anchorage, in my understanding, but they talk with the assessment folks for the municipality ahead of time and try to reach some sort of resolution about the valuation. I think most disagreements are handled in this way, and only after the Department of Revenue and the people that have been assessed the taxes haven't been able to reach an agreement or have unresolved issues that might be unique or otherwise, then they notice the board that a hearing needs to be held, essentially.
A follow-up? So as the assessment board, the role of the board is just to assess the property, not to negotiate with or try to work out any disagreements. I mean, do you guys have that first step in trying to agree with the people that are disagreeing? Or you just hand it over to DOR right away?
I think it's more that DOR hands it over to us. We don't really see things unless there actually is a resolution that can't be reached between DOR and the taxpayer, essentially. Okay. The board is more focused on not so much negotiating, but more just deciding whether or not, based on the relevant case law, statutes and regulations, whether or not the assessment is correct, and if it's incorrect, what might actually be the correct assessment.
I have a follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Klum.
Yeah, so up until now, it seems like it's those tax settlements and these agreements being made have not been very transparent. Do you support making those settlements and those numbers public?
Thank you very much to the chair. I can answer your question as best as I can. I wasn't necessarily aware that the settlement numbers weren't actually public. I know that in my limited experience, I know that the meetings of the board are public, but whether or not all settlements are that don't get to the board are public, I'm not aware. I don't really have an opinion because this is the first time I'm hearing of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. Laffey, for joining us today. We will now set this appointment aside, and we'll take a brief at ease while the next presenter joins us. So back on the record, next up we'll hear House Bill 33 relating to participation in matters before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by the members of the respective boards from Representative Stutes. This is the second hearing of this bill in House Resources. And just a reminder, there was an amendment deadline that was set for noon today, and we have not received any amendments. And now we will reopen public testimony on House Bill 33. Is there anyone in the room or online who would like to testify on House Bill 33? If so, please join us and put yourself on record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry McCune. I'm a commercial fisherman out of Cordova, Alaska. And I've been probably going to board meetings since 1970, so I guess that kind of dates me a little bit. But I'll be representing myself for this testimony. I always thought that I'd put my name in for the Board of Fish, but right now, the way it's set up, I'd be conflicted out because I have a permit. I also have a son that fishes in the fishery, and I have a daughter that fishes in Bristol Bay. So I'd be conflicted out there, too. So any proposal that came up as conflict between groups, I would have to sit in the audience and not be able to say anything. Only in the committee of the whole, you might get a couple minutes out of 100 people or 20 people, how many people are in that committee to talk. So if there was anything that came up at the board that in my area that I'm an expert on was asked of Fish and Game, most of the time Fish and Game can't answer anything that has anything to do with the harvester. You know, they're just managing. Or some kind of thing about the gear or anything, you can't say anything. So, but I think it's time that this board has experts from every area. They know every fishery in the state is really difficult. So if you have somebody that can say something that may be able to answer the question of the board during deliberations, I think that's only fair. And most of the time, 99.9% of the time, it's a commercial fisherman that is conflicted out. If you own a $5 million lodge, most of the time you won't be conflicted out because they deem that as a service, not commercial. So I think it's time that we let people be able to talk. They can't vote unless somebody voted and said they could. You know, I mean, the board would have to say that, but if they're conflicted out, they can't vote. But I think it's time to let them sit at the table and be able to answer questions if they're experts in their particular area. Sometimes I seen one time two people were conflicted out down here in Southeast. And I think John Jensen, he lost 25 proposals conflicted out one time because his son had a permit. Very seldom anybody else but a commercial fisherman, like I said. So for those reasons, I support the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McCune. We do have questions from committee members. Representative Sadler.
Thank you to the chair, Mr. McCune. Could you amplify? You say they deem that you said that mostly those members of the board who are conflicted out, as they say, are commercial fishermen, but lodge owners are not because you said they deem that a service. Could you expand on that? I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Please make it more clear.
To the chair, Representative Sadler. Well, 90% of the time, the way the commercial is written by, are interpreted by the Department of Law. The other sport fishermen or lodge owners or guides are not commercial. They're just a service provided to the public. Where I go and I sell my fish, so they're deeming it as commercial, and it may affect, or maybe if I made an allocative decision, you put more fish in the fishery, and I might benefit from that. You don't see it the other way around. That's the way I understand the rulings by the board and the Department of Law.
Thanks.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. I was just curious, from your perspective, why do you suppose anybody would be in opposition of this?
To the chair, that's a very good question. I would say, if I'm going to be real frank about this, that if you're, let's say that you're avid sport fish or sport fishing group, as you know Krissa is, if a person's conflicted out, they can't vote on that particular issue. So lots of times that's a blessing for somebody that may be in favor of that proposal or not in favor of that proposal. But at the same time, they argue that the person shouldn't be able to sit up there and say anything about the proposal because they're conflicted out. But I disagree because very seldom they're conflicted out. So every once in a while, but not very, very rare, that anybody's conflicted out besides commercial, you know, I think they should be able to speak.
Follow up,
Representative Elam.
So what makes this conflict of interest any different than any other conflict of interest off other boards? And I ask that from the perspective of I've been conflicted out of various boards and areas due to interests in different groups. And so if a conflict is a conflict, what makes this conflict any different than the others?
Through the chair, I think it's a different board. If you have the chiropractic board, they're all chiropractors. They all have some kind of opinion or are been in the service. They know about it. But if I'm from Prince William Sound, everybody's from Yukon, Cook Inlet. I know a little bit about every fishery in the state after 60 years, but I'm not an expert in every fishery in the state. So it's a very limited board. It's a very contentious subject the Board of Fish take up, you know, because people are very passionate about fish. And so I think that it's really hard to find a lot of people that know about that particular issue in your area. I wouldn't pretend to be sitting on the board to speak for the people from the Yukon. I don't know that much about that fishery. I know a little bit, but I would rely on a lot of the people in the area to tell me and be able to understand it. But if you have a question that can't be answered, then I think it should be answered from somebody that knows that area.
Follow up, Representative Elam, and then Representative Sadler.
Yeah. Final thing. Thank you. I appreciate your insight. I know you've been around this for a long time. That's why I'm going to ask you a few more questions. Do you feel that the board representation is evenly distributed, or is there how does that work? Because what I've found is, like, when you take things like the chiropractic boards, it's all chiropractors, and they all have the same interests. But whenever you have, you know, sport guides or versus commercial, you know, it's like, is it disproportionate? Does everybody have an equal voice at the table?
To the chair, that's a very good question right now, because the way they're appointed, it's very vague on the statute that appoints board members. It doesn't really say a lot. So it's up to the governor and the legislature to form the board that's going to be there. I've seen where the board's too much commercial. Now I feel the board's too much sport. And I think they're using the board in a manner that shouldn't be used, and they have what they call a board-generated proposal, and they put it together, and they could put a whole fishery out of business, such as in Cook Inlet was tried just recently, without any public comment. And that's frankly wrong. And so I don't think we have a real balanced board. It's up to the governor to appoint the people to balance it out, but it's very vague, like I say, in the statute on the people that you put on the board. But I think that we could do some work to make the board a little bit better and more balanced all the way around for subsistence, commercial, sport. But the way it is now, it's just whoever gets appointed is going to have the majority on the board. And if you got four votes, you got four votes. And everybody, you know, fights to get their votes and to have a proposal passed or not passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you to the chair, Mr. McCune. I guess I'm going to put this in the form of a question, but it's more of a statement, I think. I believe the difference between the Board of Chiropractic Examiners and the Board of Fish is that the Board of Fish is an allocative body. It decides who will get fish, what gear type, or at least one group or location might get fish. The Board of Chiropractors does not decide who, you know, I guess once you're a chiropractor, they don't say we're going to get more chiropractic patients in the Mat-Su and fewer in the Southeast and more in the interior and so forth. I think that's the essential difference, that the Board of Fish isn't allocative. They allocate. And I think that's an important distinction. So is that true?
Through the chair, well, I would say, this is what I would say. I would say that if I was a small chiropractor and there's a bunch of big chiropractors on there, you know, they might make some decision that affects my business. So that's the same thing in fisheries. I mean, we could affect how many fish a subsistence person gets, commercial gets, there's a balance. And, you know, you have to have some kind of balance on the board also to be make those decisions. And that's up to the governor and the legislature to appoint those people.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. McCune, for your public testimony. I think that concludes all of the questions from the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up for public testimony, we have Tracy Welsh, Executive Director with United Fishermen Alaska. Tracy, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Burke, Co-Chair Dibert, members of the House Resources Committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify here today on what's this snowy St. Patrick's Day. For the record, my name is Tracy Welsh, and I'm the Executive Director for United Fishermen of Alaska. For those of you who are unfamiliar with UFA, UFA is the statewide commercial fishing trade association, and we currently represent 35 commercial fishing organizations that participate in fisheries throughout the state and federal fisheries off Alaska's coast. We also represent approximately 500 individual members at this time. UFA strongly supports House Bill 33, an act relating to participation in matters before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by members of their respective boards. We've already submitted written testimony to the committee in support of the bill, so in the interest of time, I'll keep my comments relatively brief today. USA has long advocated for allowing Board of Fisheries members to participate in deliberations, but to abstain from voting when they're considered to have a conflict of interest. As you may know, Alaska's fisheries are diverse in area, species, and types of fisheries. As such, issues facing the board members are often unique to specific areas and species, which oftentimes is far outside the knowledge base of many of the members serving on the board. This bill would allow board members who have subject matter expertise the ability to stay at the table and participate in the discussion about a specific proposal, what it means, and speak to the allocative aspects of the proposal if necessary, but most importantly, to be able to clarify when it becomes apparent that the board members are not understanding the effects and the intent of a proposal before them. To be clear, the conflicted member would not be allowed to make amendments, substitute motions, vote on the amendments, vote on the proposal, or vote whether a proposal should be brought back for reconsideration. So in conclusion, we believe the bill would provide an improvement to the deliberative process and would lead to more informed and balanced fisheries management decisions at the Board of Fisheries here in Alaska. That concludes my prepared testimony today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Welsh. We do have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Welsh, I feel I can ask you this question because in your position, you're probably pretty darn well informed about these issues. My question is this. My reading of the bill indicates that there is not an absolute prohibition against a member with a conflict of interest cannot vote. My understanding is the bill would allow that person to vote on an issue, even if they had an interest. I won't say conflict of interest, but an interest. If a majority of the board or if the supervisor determined that there was no conflict. So I guess my question to you is, do you believe that this bill is an absolute prohibition against a member being able to vote on an issue in which they have an interest?
That's a nuance that I'm not, through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a nuance that I'm not familiar with. My understanding on the initial read of the bill and in subsequent years or in previous years, that if a member was deemed to not have a conflict, that they would be able to participate in discussion at all levels and to vote. This bill, the intent was not to change that. It was just to allow people who have conflicts the ability to sit at the table and participate in discussion and to kind of help clarify matters, but would not change the conflict of interest.
Yeah. And follow up,
Representative.
And I will bring this up when the sponsor is before us. My understanding is that if that is, I understand the intent, but my understanding is that the language of the bill on the second page does still allow an avenue by which a member with an interest in an issue may be able to vote with the compliance of the supervisor or majority of the other members of the board. So we'll ask that question at the right time. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Seeing no further questions, thank you so much, Ms. Welsh, for your public testimony. Next up for public testimony, we have Nels Evans with the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association. Mr. Evans, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Hi, my name is Nels Evans, Executive Director of Petersburg Vessel Owners Association, or PVOA. PVOA members participate in state and federal fisheries throughout Alaska and along the West Coast, and our members rely on sound management structures to ensure the longevity and stability in the industry. We are in support of House Bill 33. As previous testifiers have already stated, normally, for the way the Board of Fish is already structured, those that have the most experience and knowledge on fisheries issues from the commercial sector are more often than not conflicted out from being able to participate in the conversations. They cannot provide that nuanced information that is often missed within the conversation, and oftentimes there are questions that occur from other board members during that final deliberation before decision making that they are just unable to provide that important information. The Board of Fisheries is an allocated board, and it's allocated between three user groups: subsistence, sport, and commercial. And as previous testifiers already signified, commercial is the only member group out of those three that is commonly conflicted out. The conflict does not allow for commercial members to partake in that conversation, whereas sport fishermen or subsistence users of that same exact resource with that split allocation are allowed to participate in that conversation as well as make those voting decisions. We're very supportive of what HB 33 is trying to do. We understand the difference between participating in the conversation and having that final vote. We do believe that allowing someone with commercial fishing experience, interest, or family members that are still participating in the commercial fisheries to provide context to the nuances we experience through our various fisheries in the state is critical to sound management. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Evans. Are there any questions for Mr. Evans? Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much. Next up for public testimony is Linda Benkin with Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. Ms. Benkin, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Yeah, hello and good afternoon to members of the board. This is Linda Benton. I'm director of Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. As others have said in testimony, our organization is likewise in support of HB 33. We support allowing Board of Fish members to participate in deliberations, but abstain from voting when they're considered to have a conflict of interest. To clarify, we believe that board members with immediate familial conflict should be able to stay at the table while deliberations occur, share their expertise, participate in the discussion about what the proposal means, speak to the allocative aspects of the proposal if necessary, and more importantly, clarify when it becomes apparent that board members are not understanding the effects or intents of a proposal. This can sometimes be done by speaking to the proposal directly or by asking ADF&G staff the right question. We have noticed over the years that sometimes, even when the board is asked for information and direction from staff on how a proposal is allocated, those questions are not always answered because ADF&G does not want to appear to be arguing for one side or another. Having recently sat through the Southeast Board of Fisheries process, I wanted to address comments that I have heard recently of opposition or question of whether this proposal is unnecessary given that a board member who is conflicted out could testify as part of a public or could participate in the committee of the whole. And I would just say that after committee of the whole, after public testimony at the Southeast Board of Fish meeting, we still had a board member who was mixing up, trawling and trolling, making comments suggesting that chum fish were worth more value to the troll fishery than Chinook, just clearly misunderstanding a lot of the information that had been presented, that to us really underscored the importance of having someone at the table with that local knowledge. So I'll stop there, support what you've heard from others, and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Benkin. Are there any questions for Ms. Benkin? Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much for your public testimony. Next up for public testimony, we have Mark Richards, the Executive Director with Resident Hunters of Alaska. Mr. Richards, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Burke. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Burke, Co-Chair Dibert, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. We're an all-Alaskan grassroots hunting conservation organization with over 3,500 members from across the state who want to see our wildlife sustainably managed with an emphasis on protecting and enhancing resident hunting opportunities. We support House Bill 33 as long as any board members who declare a conflict aren't allowed to vote on that particular proposal. I've been participating in Board of Game and Board of Fisheries meetings for going on 20 years. And just like the legislative process, board members do discuss proposals privately outside the public view, and they lobby for certain proposals just like legislators may lobby for certain legislation. So allowing board members to declare a conflict to participate in deliberations, well, we really don't see that resulting in any major swinging of votes. It can, however, provide more intimate knowledge of a particular issue, which isn't a bad thing. Excuse me. Board members read and review proposals ahead of time, and often they have already made up their mind how they are going to vote, just like legislators ahead of a hearing like this. That's the frank reality. Again, as long as a board member who declares a conflict on a proposal and can't vote on that proposal, we support this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you so much, Mr. Richards, for your public testimony. We do have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Richards, I appreciate you coming forth. Much of the testimony is coming from people with interest in the fish side, and I appreciate hearing your perspective from the Board of Game process or side of things. My question to you is, my understanding is there is an opportunity for a member of the Board of Fish or the Board of Game to comment as a member of the public to the board and to answer questions from the board about issues during deliberations. Is that sufficient opportunity for a member of the board to participate without taking part in the deliberations themselves, in your view?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, so only at the Board of Fisheries meetings during the committee of the whole process does a board member, can a board member testify like you described. And again, I don't see any problem with that on the committee of the whole process and or on the Board of Game side.
If I may follow up?
Follow up.
And it's been a lot of years since I've covered the Board of Fish or Board of Game. So you're saying that opportunity for the member to testify as a member of the public is limited to the committee of the whole? Is that how does that committee of the whole process work? How much of the deliberative process is the committee and the whole procedure? Help us understand that, please.
The committee of the whole process, again, through the chair, Representative Stadler, the committee of the whole process is unique, again, to the Board of Fisheries. And what that does is it allows all of the stakeholders to sit at the table together to discuss a proposal and to deliberate on a proposal. And then they move forward before that, and then they go to the actual deliberations of the board. I think it's a great process for the Board of Fisheries. It's not really necessary on the Board of Game side. The fisheries issues are much more complex and more, they require more discussion and deliberation. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, Representative Sadler.
I guess I would follow up through the chair, Mr. Richards. So you're saying that that process is the discussions of the Board of Fisheries, it's beneficial. Is that not available to members of the Board of Game and members who want to testify as a member of the public to the Board of Game? Is that simply not possible or just not usual?
Yeah, so we don't, through the chair, Representative Feather, we don't have the committee of the whole process with the Board of Game. So Board of Game members, during a meeting, they're not allowed to go out there and then testify as a member of the public. They're there to represent the board and deliberate on the proposals as a board member.
And I guess last question. I promise last one.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
And through the chair, Mr. Richards, in your experience, do members of the Board of Fish, I know your interest is in game, but your experience, do members of the Board of Fish avail themselves often of the opportunity to testify during the committee and the whole process?
I've Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm trying to think back. The last meeting I was at, I have seen that, I think, a couple of times in my 20 years going to meetings.
Thank you. Are there, seeing no further questions, thank you so much, Mr. Richards, for your public testimony. Next up for public testimony, we have Susan Doherty, General Manager for Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. Ms. Doherty, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Yes, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Susan Doherty. I'm the General Manager of Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association in Ketchikan, Alaska. I want to speak in support of House Bill 33. Board members' expertise in a particular area are important to fleshing out valuable information concerning potential regulatory changes. And too many times I've seen that board members don't have the necessary knowledge to ask the appropriate question to Fish and Game to adequately get out specific information that would help them rule on a particular proposal in front of them. And I understand if you have a conflict not being able to vote, but for a board member to be able to share their knowledge with other board members seems to be counterproductive to why they were selected in the first place. Why would you curtail perhaps the only sitting member with history or knowledge from using that to help make the best decision going forward? And I'd like to answer a couple of questions that were posed to other folks who called in. One, the last part of this bill about board members being able to vote whether someone had a conflict or not, that happens during the ethics statements. A member will put on that my son or my daughter-in-law or this or that, and the board votes whether or not that person is conflicted out and in which proposals they would be conflicted out in. So I believe that's where that language is speaking to at the end of this bill. Additionally, the fact that a conflicted out member can speak during the committee of the whole, you are only able to give testimony of new information during committee of the whole. You are not able to ever ask the department a question or someone else a question that would bring out information that is important about the allocation or about the fishery. That's the important piece, is that the commercial board member who has a commercial background knows the fishery intimately enough to ask a question that should be asked to make a good decision. And if you don't have that person participating, a lot of times misinformation is not corrected, and information that should be available to the board members is never asked in the first place. So that's what this bill is trying to get to, is enabling those folks with the expertise to ask a question, get that information out so that everybody can make the best informed decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty, for your public testimony. We do have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Doherty, and I appreciate that, the insight and that precision. Would you would your view on this bill change if there was an absolute prohibition of a member of the Board of Fisheries from voting, if they were allowed to participate in deliberation and ask the questions as you described? Would it be therefore okay with you if the member were absolutely prohibited from voting on that issue?
Through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, the reason the board members vote during the ethics portion is that there may not be a conflict, but the board member is stating, I have this connection. Some of the connections are very obvious, and it's easy to say you're conflicted out. Some of them are judgment calls, and the board makes those judgment calls, and it's still up to the board to vote. So I don't know how you could say they're absolutely conflicted out, because somebody has to determine whether that conflict exists or not.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
And thank you. And my specific question to the chair, Ms. Doherty, is would it change your view on the board if the language of this bill did prohibit the person from voting, whether or not the board decided or the supervisor decided there was a conflict or not? How would you feel about the bill if there was an absolute prohibition against the member voting in issue in which they had an interest?
I don't think it would change my opinion. I just don't know how you would come to that conclusion that they're conflicted out without discussion. So I don't know who, would you then leave that up to the chairperson instead of the whole board? So it's one person's opinion versus seven? I mean, I don't understand who would say that's a conflict. I don't understand how you could even do that.
I'll just answer and then I'll be done. It would simply be a prohibition against them voting on an issue in which they disclose the interest. Not a decision by an individual or the board, just a flat prohibition. But thank you for your question.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Seeing no further questions, thank you for so much, Ms. Doherty, for your public testimony. Next up for public testimony, I've got Malcolm Milne with North Pacific Fisheries Association. Mr. Milne, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Malcolm Milne. I'm with the North Pacific Fisheries Association based in Homer, Alaska. I am personally a Alaska resident of Homer, Alaska myself. So North Pacific Fisheries Association, also NPFA, represents around 65 commercial fishermen who participate in a variety of federal and state fisheries throughout Alaskan waters. NPFA was founded in 1955, and the organization has participated in the Board of Fisheries process since its inception. We did submit written comments to the committee, but that just went in today, so you may not have seen them yet. In any case, we support HB 33, and actually most of what I have written out here was mainly said by the earlier testimony, so I would just I don't have anything new to add other than I concur with the other fishing groups and as to how important this is to allow board members to participate. But I agree with the as what's been brought up that they should not be able to vote if they've been conflicted. In reading it, that's how I interpreted it, but it's certainly not crystal clear. So that's our group's position, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Milne. Apologies on the pronunciation of your last name. I don't see any questions in the room, so I just want to thank you for joining us today and giving your public testimony. And lastly, we have our final person on the line to provide public testimony. We've got Nate Rose, Vice President with Kodiak Seniors Association. Mr. Rose, please put yourself on record and begin your public testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nate Rose. I'm with the Kodiak Seniors Association out of Kodiak. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, House Resource Committee. Thanks for listening to our testimony. Kodiak Seniors Association represents our seniors, roughly 75 salmon seine operators out of Kodiak, Alaska. And we're calling in to issue our support for HB 33 as well. Not going to reiterate too many of the other comments other than to say in an area like Kodiak with 23 different sockeye systems and 200-plus pink salmon systems and 200-plus chum salmon-producing rivers in Kodiak and overlapping run timings and overlapping run dynamics, for Board of Fish members to understand the complexity of our management plan is so, it takes sometimes an entire cycle or two cycles before they completely understand how complex it is. And I think that's why you see a reluctance for participation in the Board of Fish process from the commercial sector, because ultimately the knowledge and the wisdom and the understanding of how different management plans in different areas around the state, how they interact and how they work and how allocations work, that gets lost if you can't even be a source of knowledge for the Board of Fish process. And so I would urge you guys to lend your support to this bill. I think it will provide some sincerity, some clarity to the Board of Fish process that has been missing. And it's also our understanding that those individuals could participate in deliberations, but they can't vote. We're not asking for that. We're just asking that knowledge be able to be utilized within the board process. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rose. Seeing no questions, is there anyone else on the line or in the room that would like to provide public testimony at this time? Seeing and hearing none, public testimony is now closed. I would now like to invite Representative Stutz for a closing statement on House Bill 33.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs Burke and Divert, and hello to the Resource Committee. There's a little confusion here, and I'm going to see if I can clear it up. Let me back up. Representative Stutz, District 5, for the record. Thank you. First of all, I think it was made fairly clear that the Board of Fish and the Board of Game are unique boards because, as Representative Sadler mentioned, they are allocative boards. They are allocating a resource of the state, and that is the only two boards that have that. I'm not going to read all of this. I'm only going to try and point out some clarifying statements to help you folks with your deliberations on this. First of all, it's not only imprudent for a board member to participate during public comments. That would be no different than one of these committee members testifying on this bill as a public member. It's somewhat the same idea. And I can go on to all the reasons, such as during deliberations, amendments are made, new lines of questioning arise. That's a really important part of the process in deliberating, as we all know, having experienced it. So that is the heart of this bill. So if you look at the bill itself, on page 2, starting on line 22, it says, if a member of the board or commission objects to the ruling of the supervisor, or if the supervisor discloses an involvement requiring a determination, the members present at the meeting, excluding the involvement member, shall vote on the matter. That's there now. That's in existing law now. What this bill says on page 3 is, if the supervisor or a majority of the members of the respective board determine that a member's further involvement will result in having a conflict, the member may not vote. And it references the ethics the ethics
statutes.
Thank you. That's all this bill does. It doesn't change the qualifications of a conflict. It doesn't change anything except one thing. If the board says you have a conflict and they vote to say, gee, you really don't, you may not vote. You may participate in the discussion, but you may not vote because it would be a violation of the Ethics Act. That's the only thing we're changing in this bill. If you look at the statute, it's listed out clearly what a conflict is. And so there was a little confusion, I think, as to what this bill does. It just says, as I've said 3 or 4 times, you may not vote if you are declared to have a conflict and it's been voted down. It doesn't matter. You don't get to vote. You get to discuss in the conversation. And that's the problem. We have people now that are conflicted out. that have been put on that board, on these boards, because of their knowledge, their area of expertise, and they're not allowed to participate in the discussion. Why are they on the board if that's the case? Let them participate, just don't allow them to vote. So I hope I've cleared that up, and if I haven't, I would be happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you, Representative Stutz. Representative Mears has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. And Representative Stutz, a little more broad than that, is that there are people that are self-selecting themselves out from applying to be on the Board of Fish because of their experience, and they don't think they'd be able to fully participate in the process. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct, through the chair.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, to the sponsor. So I understand the point you're making, Representative Stutz, so I understand them. I'll make sure you understand that. I understand. Line 4-7 on page 3 says that if the supervisor or majority of the board determine that a member's involvement will result in a violation, that member may not vote. Understand that. We're together so far?
Correct.
Very good. And continuing. So is it therefore true that if the supervisor and majority determine that the member's involvement will not result in a violation, may that member vote?
Through the chair, run that past me one more time, Representative Sadler.
Is it true that if the supervisor or majority of the voting members determine that a member's involvement will not result in a violation, that member may vote?
Yes.
On that issue, that's correct?
Yes, but through the chair, Representative Sadler, keep in mind that the statute clearly delineates what a conflict is. And what it, so, you know, that is, if the supervisor and the members are looking at something different, it's something outside what the statute would consider to be a conflict.
Representative Sadler?
And through the chair, Representative Sousa, the statute, that being, can you give me a specific reference as to where that is, please?
Yes.
Or maybe.
We have the statute in here.
952.
It's through the chair, Representative Sadler. It would find AS 39.52.960, Section 9, Section 18, Section 11. That's what, by statute, constitutes a conflict.
And I will look at that, and I will nail this down. I'll track it down. My concern is that as I read it, the final arbiter of whether or not the member with the announced potential interest can vote is not up to the statute, but it is up to a majority vote of the other members. And it's up to the supervisor. So I just want to make sure. I'm trying to get to that there's not a backdoor way to allow somebody to vote improperly on an issue in which they have a personal. I can understand the desire to make sure that the member with an interest is not prohibited from discussing the issue. My concern is whether they can actually finally vote or not. Now we'll look at the statute and see.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair Burke. So, through the chair, I had a question on page 2, line 20. And I think this came up when you guys were here before, but I don't know if we really had a definitive answer. And that is when it keeps referring to the supervisor, they'll shall determine whether the member's involvement violates. And then on the other page, if the supervisor or the majority of members, you know, it keeps referring to that. And I'm not clear, who is this supervisor?
That would be the chair. Through the chair, Representative Colom, that would be the chair of the Board of Fish.
Okay, so it's the chair. That's what's an existing. Oh, sorry. Follow up. Chair. Was that an existing statute, or is that part of it being amended?
That's the Representative Colom through the chair. That's the existing statute.
Okay. Again, one follow up, Representative Colom. So through the chair, I was looking at this Background on Ethics Act process that you guys gave us, and There is quite a bit of board recusals, for sure. I mean, these aren't. This is from 2005 to 2018, so not super recent. So I can see the difference between the Board of Game and the Board of Fisheries, because they only had 64 recusals, and the Board of Fisheries had 476.
Correct.
That's pretty substantial. So I guess with that, and we didn't hear too much from people from the Board of Game, but do you think this is going to affect how the Board of Game operates?
Not through the chair, Representative Colomb, Representative Stutes, for the record. Not near to the degree the Board of Fish, not even close. And I have had conversations with members from the Board of Game, and they don't seem to have any opposition. I haven't had any pushback from the Board of Game, and they didn't feel like it would be very effective or affect them much. And so let me say one more time, if there has been determined by the chair or by the supervisor that there is no violation, the individual may vote. Okay. If there has been determined to be a violation or an ethics violation, either by the committee or by statute, the member may not vote, but they may participate in the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Representative Stutes? Representative Sadler.
If I may, through the chair, may I ask your staffer a question?
Of course.
Ms. Pearson, having been a designated ethics supervisor for a department at one point, I'm just trying to flip through the Executive Ethics Act real quick. Is there any place at which for the Department of Fish and Game, and I guess it's the Board of Fish, where there is a distinction between the supervisor, which the sponsor has said is the chairman, and the designated ethics supervisor? Are they one and the same?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. The supervisor mm-hmm. would be the chair. There is an attorney general member present to help with legal issues. Okay. So that would probably be your ethics person there for you.
Okay.
Representative Elam.
Oh, sorry. Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. If there is actually a member from the Department of Law available to ask that question, I'd appreciate the chance to throw that up.
We don't have anybody. We don't have anybody.
Apologies.
Representative Stutes or Mr. McHugh, right? Sorry.
I don't believe, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I don't believe we have anybody from the Department of Law on, and I'm not sure that the liaison, Joe Feckle, from the Department of Fish and Game, I'm not sure this is up his alley.
My apologies. I thought I had heard there was. So sorry.
Christy Tibbles is online?
It's actually Art Nelson.
Oh, sorry.
Perfect.
Art Nelson is on the line. The Executive Director of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Nelson, can you take a stab at that question?
Yes, I can, Madam Chair.
Would you like Representative Sadler to repeat his question?
Yes, if you could, please. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To the Chair, Mr. Nelson, appreciate that. I just want to clarify, there's reference in the bill to supervisor, and there's reference in the Executive Branch Ethics Act about designated supervisors. I just want to clarify for myself and other members, is there any situation in which the supervisor is someone other than the designated ethics supervisor?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I believe they're one and the same. The chair of the Board of Fisheries is the designated ethics supervisor for the board.
That's what I wanted. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for... Oh, sorry, Representative Elam.
Thank you. In the conversations and everything as they've kind of gone, so this does include the Board of Game. Is there any kind of component to the Board of Game that would have something comparable to how commercial fisheries has kind of commercial allocations versus sport fisheries doesn't really have kind of the same... You know, it's more subsistence and personal use type areas. Is there a component to the Board of Game that has a kind of a commercial component?
Representative Elam, through the chair, I'm not exactly sure of that. There are hunts that are sold. I know that, you know, the game can be shut down, you know, just the way fisheries can if there's not enough allocation there. Mm-hmm. But I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
Representative Elam, if I might, I would imagine through the guides there might be, because you have guided hunts and you have not guided hunts. I really, frankly, haven't delved into it too much because, as I said earlier, the Board of Game doesn't expect this to have much of an effect, if any, on them. They don't seem to have the conflict situation that the fisheries do.
You may follow up?
Follow up, Representative Elam.
The reason I ask is, as I'm kind of dealing through some more of this, I have a lot of all of the different fisheries in my district, and it feels to me as if the Board of Game doesn't have the same level of balance problems within their board versus, say, the Board of Fisheries, where if you get lopsided with commercial or you get lopsided with sport or you get lopsided with subsistence, then you have the ability to kind of weaponize the muting of someone's voice. And so as I'm seeing all of this go through, if you have a heavy load of commercial fisheries versus sport fisheries, it, that doesn't seem to really exist so much when we get into the game side of things, which is what I was looking at as we were going through. And so that's why I was asking if there was like a commercial component within the game side of things. So, thank you.
Representative Elam, Representative Stutz, again, for the record. The two boards have, the user groups of the two boards, the Board of Fish and the Board of Game, they their boards are very similar. They have basically the same structure, and they are hoping to maintain that same structure because they are both allocative. And so that's why you probably haven't heard much from the Board of Game, because it isn't going to be that much of an effect on them, but yet they have no problem with this particular change in the board structure.
Thank you. Representative Cologne.
Thank you. Chair Burke, I just wanted to make sure, just in full disclosure, in our opposition packet, there is an opposing letter to this bill from Ted Spraker that was a chair of the Board of Game for 18 years, so just something to consider.
Representative Cologne, are there any further questions? Seeing and hearing none, Co-Chair Dibert, do you have a motion?
I do. Co-Chair Burke, thank you. I move House Bill 33, Work Order 34-LS0328/A from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Object.
There is an objection from Representative Sadler. Representative Sadler, would you like to speak to your objection?
I still have some concerns about the provision which would allow a member with a declared conflict to vote. I need to research it more, so I just want to vote no. I'll vote amend.
Thank you. Very well. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Pass.
Representative Cologne.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
Pass.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Hall.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
No.
Representative Rauscher.
No.
Co-Chair Burke.
Yes.
Five yeas, four nays.
And with a vote of five yeas and four nays, House Bill 33 passes from committee. That completes the agenda for House Resources Committee meeting today. Thank you again to our presenters and to our testifiers. Our next House Resources meeting is Wednesday, March 19 at 1 p.m. The time now is 2:54 p.m. and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.